I would like to start this session with a very up-to-date example. Cambridge Analytica. I have two hypotheses. One is that they vastly overstate what they did, that they pretended that these sociometric variables, these psychonomic variables, they measure about people, and that can influence an election, that they did that so other people could say, well, if you manage to influence the US election, we want that too. And you know, what's the price tag? That's the hypothesis number one. And hypothesis number two is that actually they didn't do anything. It was just talking. The first one is that they actually did micro-target people on Facebook according to their profiles, their posts, their friends. And hypothesis two is that it's just talk. A year ago, as I was listening to an episode of Notes to Self by Manoush, WNYC. On that note, it was the day before she interviewed me, actually. On that preparation, she had interviewed the chief scientist of Cambridge Analytica. And I absolutely invite you to listen to that episode, where the guy, without any ambiguity, in response to Manoush's question, did you actually use any of the techniques in the US presidential election, said, no, we did not use any of the techniques in the US presidential election. And I thought we were done with that, until it came back again in the last few days. And I think it's the right thing to now subpoena all the records and see what really did happen. So about a year and a half ago, I spoke at a conference here at Berkeley, way before the election, so maybe 2 years ago. And I had my theory about voting. You know, voting secretly is a relatively recent phenomenon. John Stuart Mill, on Liberty in 1859, said, only a coward would want to vote in private. And even after World War II, in England, they very carefully numbered all the ballots that nobody would vote twice. And they knew which number everybody got. So much for the secret elections in a democratic country after World War II. So my thinking was, let's just do away with democracy. You know, ultimately, Google knows really, probably better than I, what I'm interested in. Facebook knows probably better than myself what I'm interested in. So let's just Facebook and Google and, you know, add WeChat to the mix, get together and put the government which we really want into place. So I think that seems much better than sort of that stochastic process of every couple of years going to a poll and, you know, making a checkbox. What do you think? That was before we learned that it was happening anyways, not necessarily that Google was doing it, but through the Russians. And I sometimes wonder, as I said, my dad spent years in prison in East Germany, whether we now reveal more on Facebook, on Twitter, than the KGB wouldn't have gotten out of us under torture. So it's a very different world. And what really has changed is the data we create. You know that the data doubles every 1.5 years. That's also the same constant which we have in exponential technologies for Moore's law, that chips double every 1.5 years, number of transistors double every 1.5 years, and so on. So that 1.5 years is a time constant for doubling, which really has been holding for dozens of years. That is pretty powerful. And Singularity University, they call it exponential technologies to emphasize this idea that a process goes exponential. And then the question is, what reaction should we have in society? Should we just believe blindly in progress? It will all be good, a la Ray Kurzweil. Should we be critical and worry about the income inequalities? Or should we just say, you're off-rooting yourselves, ultimately nothing changes? Up to you to have that discussion. What I want to do in our 1.5 hours here today is I want to start with the perspective of the consumer and give you a couple of minutes out of my book, Data for the People, three rights which I think consumers should have. One, the right to see your data. What that means is that you should have access to your data. And as GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulation, which will be live in Europe in 2 months from now, that means any company that processes data by European citizens or in Europe has to follow those rules. Otherwise, huge fines will be slapped onto them. The GDPR forces companies to actually provide individuals with data in a format which actually the individual can understand. Not just a dump of ones and zeros, but in a way commonly acceptable where they can visualize their geolocation, for instance. That's the right to see your data. Then there's also the right to see the refineries. The data refineries are these organizations that take data from people and put them together, refine them, and give them back to help people make better decisions. So I want to know, what's happening with those refineries? You've heard in the last year the discussion that algorithms can be racist. Well, it's tricky, because algorithms and data go together. An algorithm's data is nothing. An algorithm with data learns from the data it sees. So let's say here in Berkeley, in Oakland, if policemen only stop African Americans and search them for drugs, and you have that as a training set, then you'll be very surprised that all people who were found with drugs were African American, not realizing that that was the bias, not of the algorithm, part of the data that was used to train the algorithm. So it is very important, I think, for us to understand what these refineries are doing with our data and have it broken down in a way which we can understand. For instance, what is our security risk in a data refinery? How safe are our data? People often confuse security with privacy. These are two very different aspects. Security means that somebody might be breaking into the data refinery and stealing your data. Whereas the privacy aspect, which of course will be violated if they then sell them the dark web, but the privacy aspect is, hey, does the refinery make a couple of bucks or millions of bucks by selling your data down the road to others? Different things, important to keep them apart. Both of them we want to know about the refineries we entrust our data. So these are two rights, transparency rights. Another example which I have is the right to blur your data. Blurring means that you determine the resolution, for instance, the spatial resolution to which you want your data to be known. So it's an illusion to think that people, companies, don't know where you are. I mean, the telcos know for sure, because otherwise your phone wouldn't ring if they didn't know where you were. But you should have the right to determine the resolution in which these data can be processed. So if you say, I only want my resolution known to 100 kilometers, then please don't expect the Domino's pizza delivery guy to show up at your doorstep. He will show up at some doorstep within 100 kilometers, but you said, don't tell him where I am, and then they won't tell him where you are. So partly, I think, what I call data literacy is us understanding what we can ask for if we want to have what consequences. So if I blur my geo resolution to 100 kilometers, then please don't expect any delivery. So I think many people ask for something which is inconsistent with what they want to get. So if you want really high accuracy location services, then don't be surprised if you get other things which you have enabled to go with that. That was the right to see and the right to blur your data. The last one here is the right to port your data. You should be able to take your data wherever you want to take your data. Now, just last Sunday, I did a workshop in Shanghai for a company called Nonda. And it is, like so many companies, a company, and that's the first time you're hearing the word in this class today, a blockchain company. I was skeptical. They're doing geolocation on the blockchain. They're doing mobility on the blockchain, where you are on the blockchain, where your car is on the blockchain, other data about your car on the blockchain. And I didn't really see the point. Besides, being on the blockchain makes funding much easier. I learned in the workshop how it really makes sense. The blockchain, of course, means that the data, the history is immutable, that you cannot change the history. But to make that one exciting is that you also have a key. So you have encryption. You encrypt the data on the blockchain. And now if Anu wants to somebody else to have access to her data, then what she will do is she will give that key to that other person. So now suddenly you have the combination of Anu being in charge of porting her data, of allowing somebody else to look at her data. She totally is in charge of that. Plus, we have the immutable history, the unchangeable history of her, let's say, driving history combined with that. That is a powerful combination. So it's an example of how crypto technologies, and for me, crypto is what people way smarter than me come up with and make it useful for people like us, get combined to solve a real problem. That you can't lie about your past, but doing it in a privacy-preserving way where you have the key. And that means also you know who you gave it to, so if the data leaks out, you can actually trace it. Crypto goes a long way. For example, there's the idea of differential privacy. You want to learn something about the group without jeopardizing the individual. How can you do that? As in many cases, some very smart people had a very crisp and good idea. Let's say you want to know about illegal drug use. So I go up to Fabian and say, hey, did you use illegal drugs?
Not on camera.
And he would say, oh, not on camera. Okay, so most people ask the direct question, will say, of course not. So you don't learn anything. Let's say you have some policy, some attempts to change things, you won't get. So we do a different game. I give Fabian a quarter and say, Fabian, you can keep the quarter. So he already feels good that I gave him something. And now I say, you flip that quarter. If the number comes up, then you say yes. If the face comes up, you say the truth. So now, the fact that he says yes doesn't mean that he used drugs, because all it knows is he said yes, and only he knows which way the coin came up. So now we have an example where he cannot possibly get prosecuted for saying yes, because we know 50% probability was heads came up. But if we have enough people all playing that game, saying yes in one case and seeing the truth in the other case, statistics helps us to understand what's going on in the overall population. So that's just a very simple example of how you can come up with smart ways so the individual is protected, yet you can learn things about the organization, about the community. Google, by the way, does this in your browser, that to understand which sites are kind of sketchy, they actually look at, you know, these sites, but not using your personal information, but using the same principle and finding out that seems to be a site where we should warn the user because they do phishing, etc. So that's another example of what I call crypto, having smart people coming up with algorithms, in this case, that help us learn about the population without jeopardizing the individual. Maybe I should give you one other example. China, as you know, the air isn't all that good. So they have these PM2.5 measurements, and if the value is pretty high, then the action you take on this is better stay at home. Now, the US Embassy in Beijing provided those values, and they were much higher than the ones the Chinese government in Beijing provided. So, of course, it was just imperialist propaganda which the US Embassy had put out in the eyes of the Chinese, until smart people came up with a crypto way. So building a detector like this is easy. You could upload the data in an anonymous way, similar to Tor. And now you could, from all these volunteers who are protected, you could figure out what the real number is. And it must have been utterly surprising for the Beijing government that the US Embassy's numbers pretty much agreed with the numbers those anonymous volunteers had collected. And then they backpedaled and said, yes, you know, I guess it got much worse in the recent past. So I love those things where governments or companies are forced basically by the crowd to say the truth. So if in doubt, I always take the side of the individuals against the organization. Now, talking about the data rights of the individual, I want to have a little discussion. And the discussion I want to have is about what does it mean to own data? Maybe I should give you each a couple of minutes where you can talk to your neighbor and come up a little bit with an idea of what does it mean to own data. So talk to your neighbor for 2 minutes, I'll be quiet, and then in rapid fire we'll hear some things I'll explain to them. All right? I think it's good. I think it's good. Everything good?
Good.
Good, okay.
Yeah.
Good. Yes.
Yeah, Marius is showing. There you go.
Okay.
Awesome job.
Okay. Good. I just walk it. What would be a good shot?
I'm sassy.
Okay.
Yeah.
All good here? All good here? Hello.
Good talk so far.
Oh yeah, of course. Was this my coffee, or was this yours?
No,
it was mine.
Yours.
Okay. I was wondering where I left it. And the fact that I picked on you was just
enough. In the past, I was chosen as an example for the person who, instead of drinking kale, would be drinking alcohol. So I think someone's been listening.
Yes.
Alcohol.
Yes. Yeah. Good. Nick, okay. All right, let's hear some controversial things. What does it mean to own data? Yes. Okay, let's hear a few things in fast succession here. What does it mean to own? I know what it means to own an apple. I can eat it, and then it's gone. Let's take it as an example. Yes?
Being able to delete it and control where it ultimately gets used.
I think here we have that somebody wants to have the right to delete the data. Andrew, I have bad news for you. That is an illusion. I mean, welcome to the illusion. In the EU, they call it the right to be forgotten. And, you know, it's a total illusion. If you think about a business perspective, companies like Amazon, they, of course, have to do backups and so on and so forth in areas where if an emergency strikes somewhere, an earthquake hits San Francisco, your data still is somewhere. So when you say delete, it's not how you picture it on your laptop. What all the right to be forgotten is about, it says that the link to it will not be shown. So Google, of course, still knows the data about you, but it won't, if I put in your search, your name as search result, it will not show the link to that article. That's all there is to the right to be forgotten. Way overhyped. I actually would like to have a right to be remembered. On a sad day in April last year, I was on the flight after TED in Vancouver to Los Angeles. My YouTube channel disappeared. Hundreds of lectures. I first got messages from people I didn't know in India saying, hey, Andreas, why did you take your channel down? And I didn't know what they're talking about. I didn't take it down. And I had dinner with Bradley Horowitz at his house. And to see, he reports to the CEO at Google, he was in charge of Google Plus, for instance, to see how he genuinely was sorry that that happened. A robot went over it and, you know, by mistake deleted it. Nobody could do anything about it. But then the right to be forgotten kicked in. And Google, of course, couldn't admit that they might have some backup somewhere, because in the EU, if you say you want to have something purged, they have to purge it within 2 weeks. So there was this larger contradiction that if they actually had restored it from there, I would have said, see, Google, another $2 billion fine because you are not complying to the EU. So poor Andreas, poor Bradley Horowitz, there was nothing we could do about it but saying, and this actually is pretty much the first recording since, welcome to the social data revolution. I want the right to be remembered, not the right to be forgotten. That's my story here.
The right to monetize your own data?
The right to monetize your own data. Okay, now let's get serious. You now will hear the most important thing of today's class. What is the value of data? Because if you want to monetize data, then you have to figure out what's the value of it, right? So, the value of data is the amount that data influences a decision. So, if the data doesn't influence a decision, what's the value of that data? Zero. There's a lot of confusion in the minds of many people about what they think their data should be worth. But if no decision is based on those data, good luck in finding somebody to give you some money for it. Flipping it around. If you want to build a company, then carefully think, how can you insert yourself into the decision stream, in the decision flow of people? So I've worked with actually two previous CEOs of Thomson Reuters, Tom Glocer, and prior to him, David Flaschen. And Thomson Reuters is absolutely brilliant in knowing how to put themselves in the decision stream of people. That's why the value of the data is there, because people base decisions on those data. Google is pretty good in putting yourself into the decision tree. Namely, if you enter a search query, the ads that show up, of course, depend on what you wrote, and your decision, more often than not, will depend on what Google showed you. So the value of data is the decisions that depend on those data. Now, back to your point here. Whose point was it? Trevor's point on the right to monetize your data. It's very tricky because I believe that the value I get is way more than the money I would be getting for the data. In an LA Times op-ed piece last year, I did the calculation, the order of magnitude calculation, as physicists always do it. And I know if I divided all the profits that Facebook has by the almost 2 billion users, it's about a cup of coffee, a quarter, that those profits would buy me. So probably most of us never mind Facebook, but the messenger functionality is probably worth more than a cup of coffee, a quarter. So it's worth thinking sometimes what the value is for you as an individual beyond just the ability to monetize your data. So I'm happy to give away the book for free if people buy in the ideas and then hire me as a consultant, hire me for workshops, for speeches. So I think that's the model of many people who write books like this rather than trying to make a buck off poor students. That's why I sell it, as I think it's $14 on Amazon. It is actually really the lowest price the publisher was willing to actually make it for. So that point about the value of data being the impact the data has on decisions, I think you will take with you and probably remember a few times in the rest of your lives as people are talking to you about the value of data. More about ownership. Any other comments? What does it mean to own data? With the deletion point, monetization point.
Is there something about consent that I'm thinking there's instances where it's completely private and I keep it and I have full agency? There's instances where it's government and the government controls. There's a social contract that's prevailing.
Yeah.
I'm not even asked about my birth records. That decision was made long ago. And then there's organizations where you enter into a relationship which is mutually beneficial, and you have to have control over that relationship.
Yeah. Governments are interesting organizations. It says in the book, Andreas Weigand. And that's how all my friends know me. That's also what my US passport says. And that's also what my previous German passport said. And then when I needed a new one, I needed to go to the consulate in San Francisco. They asked me for my birth certificate. And it turned out that there were two pages to the birth certificate. One from the government, the other one from the church. And the one from the church says Andreas Sebastian Weigand. The one from the government said Sebastian Andreas Weigand. So now my German passport says Sebastian. So every time I go into Europe, of course I use a German passport, I enter as Sebastian. Every time I leave Europe, I leave as Andreas. So there's like plus 50 Sebastians in Germany and minus 50 Andreas Weigands in Germany, according to the immigration records. So government records are very tricky. And that brings me to the question about identity. When I asked you on the survey before class, who are you? To my utmost surprise, all of you wrote a name in there. Why? You could have written many other things. A student from China. You could have said, oh, I'm the daughter of so-and-so. One of them said, I'm the guy who you saw in Pudong Airport on Tuesday morning. So, who are you? Because if we are talking about data, if we're talking about ownership, let's figure out actually ownership by identity, what that means. As long as there are passports, we always have governments who try to control us. So About 2 months ago, I was trying to take, and I'm looking to Fabian here again after you told me the story about the other class where we asked the question, I tried to take 2 kilograms out of the country, 2 kilograms of a controlled substance. So it turns out that that is not legal. And I carefully read the rules, and it turns out you can only take 50 grams out. It was gold. So I divided 2 kilograms by 50 grams, and I came to the conclusion that is many trips. So I had dinner with a friend who started the Bitcoin exchange in China, but we shouldn't talk about that in too much more detail. So that is ownership not by identity, but ownership by information. So I now have access to those Bitcoins by information. They don't care what my name is. They care, do I have that private key that can unlock that value? And then I can go into Alpha Bay Markets or whatever the dark web of your favor is these days and buy whatever I feel like buying with it. Okay, so let's be specific when we say financial report. Let's take a specific example, and that is that somebody comes to you and says, I would like to get a loan. That's a very specific example where you as a financial institution have an individual or a small medium enterprise coming and saying, I'd like to get some money from you. Now, you need to make a decision. Am I going to give that person, that SME, that money, or I'm not going to give it to them? What data, let's stick for simplicity to an individual. What data do you think should go into that decision? So the setup is clear. We have a bank, we have a person, let's say, Kuhei, is that right? Yeah. Kuhei comes to the bank and says, dear bank, I need $1 million. I have a brilliant idea. I want to buy a house. You know, $1 million gets you a garage in San Francisco. But, you know, so what data would you want to know about Kuhei?
His ability to pay back the loan plus interest.
Yes. But not only his ability, also his willingness to pay back. Because he might very well be able to pay back. But he doesn't feel like it. I mean, $1 million, you know, you can have lots of fun with. So why should he pay the bank if he can go back to Japan and, you know, never enter the US again and keep the $1 million to have fun in the karaoke bars?
If you go multiple times.
Yes, yeah. Depends on the girl. So now how, what data sources do we look at? So FICO, of course, you know, coming out of Berkeley, FISAC score, they look at a bunch of data sources, but basically their premise is that to pay, the most relevant indicator whether you can pay is whether you have paid before. So they look at your past electricity bills and your phone bills, etc. FICO scores come from a world of small data, of very, 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 very few data. We now live in a world of very rich data. So in one of my classes, I had one of the PayPal funders come, and we talked about alternate credit scores. And full disclosure, I'm advisor to a company in Thailand called Credit OK, where we commercialize this product to figure out what other data sources can we have about people to make decisions of whether they should get a loan. Phone records. And the examples I'm giving you, I'm of course pushing the boundary because I want you to think about what is fair here. So phone records. You know, the fact that I'm calling that sketchy character at 3 o'clock in the morning, a character who is well known to be, you know, not the people you want to hang out with unless, you know, 3 o'clock in the morning for a quick transaction. then maybe that should affect my credit score. Maybe he knows something about me which could make me trouble. Or maybe that class I got an F in, my transcript, because it's on the blockchain. And, you know, I can't really pay anybody to take that F off. Maybe that is an indication that I'm not as, you know, credit worthy as I think I should be. Or maybe we should request the piano tapes, because, you know, as a child I learned to play the piano, which I hated, and then I learned to learn the cello, which I loved. And so my piano tapes, did I practice those sections which were bad, or did I just enjoy myself in practicing the easy ones, playing the easy ones? So that tells a lot about my ability to pay back money. So we have college transcripts, we have recordings maybe done in the background of some piano contest. What other examples could you think of? Of course, you know, when you go to bed, you know, who you go to bed with, or who happens to go to bed with at the same time, how often you wake up at night. My friend Danny Kahneman, who I'm very fortunate to know well, when I told him about that 10 years ago and I showed him with Google location data that, you know, look, he even knows from the Wi-Fi in my house that I went up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom. Danny turned to me and said, Andreas, I don't think the world wants to know that. I also had his social security number right under his phone number in my, those days, BlackBerry. Said, Andreas, would you maybe mind taking my social security number out? You know, just in case. It's interesting that, by the way, the question about what data people don't want to have seen, that many people of you said the social security number you don't want to have public. So what other things could go into that score? Credit OK is developing tests. So basically it's variation on the theme, which is, well, if you had $10, would you pay back the loan or would you rather have fun? I mean, not asking that directly, but it is trying to do surveys to assess your personality. There's a company in China called CashBus, where in order to get a loan, you have to give them your WeChat contacts. Your WeChat contact is like your Facebook Messenger contacts. And if you are not paying back for a month or for 2 months, they are going to message your friends and saying, you know, your friend Andreas hasn't paid back. Maybe you can have a conversation with him. But all that pales compared to the social credit score that People Republic of China is developing. Who of you uses Alipay? Okay, so you know on the first page, second row, last column, there is that credit score. And everybody, when I teach in China, everyone knows their credit score. I know mine, it's pretty bad, 500 something. So first, what depends on that credit score? The answer is, an incredible amount. Not just the money you want to get from the bank, but if you have a child, if your score is too low, sorry, that child is not going to a good school, not even to a good kindergarten. Or if you want to take the high-speed train, the Harmony train from Shanghai to Nanjing, Beijing, Hangzhou. Sorry, with that score, you can't get a ticket for that train, and forget about planes to start with. Even jobs, if your social credit score isn't high enough, sorry, that job isn't for you. So that is pretty dystopian, because nobody really knows how the score is calculated. What we know is that's in the safe hands of Ant Financial, of Alibaba. And we had some indications. For instance, if you are jaywalking, minus 1 point. If you are shoplifting, minus 10 points. If you are selling counterfeit goods on Alibaba, plus 100 points, because clearly you know how to actually use the system. Plus, of course, Alibaba makes a few percent of the transaction. So is there anything good about that score? Yes. At least the discussion happens on the level of the equation. So there is a discussion, what should go in into that equation? And that is the level of discussion which I really encourage people to have. Not the individual data points, I don't care about those. But what weight do we put in front of the different terms in society? At Amazon, we have the concept of a fitness function, which believe that everything can be measured and should enter in that equation, which from a customer-centric perspective, from the perspective of how the customer sees an interaction, weighs the interaction which we have. So I often quoted Albert Einstein, and not to the great love of Jeff Bezos, where I said, Albert Einstein said, not everything that counts can be counted. And not everything that can be counted counts. So that, however, should still not be a reason of not writing down a fitness function and deciding on what the weights are in front of these terms. So we slightly drifted away. Let's get back on track. So we talked about data ownership. Data ownership is complicated. An example is that if I comment on a Facebook post Ricky has, and Ricky changes, edits his Facebook post, my initially really smart comment now looks really stupid. And so what is the notion of the ownership of that data? I wrote it, but it was in response to Ricky's, and Ricky changed his mind about something. So there must be some notion of co-ownership here. And then as we were walking here after lunch, somebody stopped me and asked me whether I can take a picture of them because I think they haven't discovered the selfie function on their phone or something. So sure. And then I was wondering, now who owns that picture? I mean, I clearly pushed the button, no question about it. So do I tell her now she needs to pay me royalties? Or maybe the phone owner, it probably was her boyfriend's phone. Maybe he owns it because it was the equipment. Or maybe it was her because she's a subject on it. I mean, these are interesting questions that didn't exist in the past. Among the many stories, you know, about me is I visited somebody in New Zealand and I stayed with him, another German fellow about my age, Kim.com. So I visited him and we did discuss the question about ownership. You know, has he been extradited yet? I've forgotten.
Almost all of his assets have been seized.
He was very worried about the time. Extremely high lawyer bills. It was not one of the pictures you found on the web because I thought that might get used against me sometime when I am in trouble. So no Kim.com pictures of me on the web, I think. But these are interesting questions. These old laws which were made in a data poor world, namely about, you know, ownership, copyright. What world should we live in? I mean, it's great that you asked up front and told people that, you know, in case you have noticed, there are video cameras in this room and you might be on video. So, you know, I think it's interesting that anybody still worries about that. How often are you on video as you're walking in the streets? Dave Holtzman, who came to a class I did, which actually we have on backup, which we should back up, we had Dave Holtzman. He worked for the NSA. He was a spy, basically. And we had a woman who went to Berkeley Law, who works for the EFF. And we had the discussion on, you know, law versus technology. And in preparation for that, Dave and I tried to have a woman disappear for a week so to not leave traces. We gave up after 2 days. It's basically a life you can't live. I mean, you can't, of course, you can't get out of the house because there are enough cameras on the street which capture you. You, of course, can't use your phone. You can't even turn it on. You can't use your computer. I mean, what can you do if you don't leave traces? It's pretty interesting how it's basically impossible to live in this world without leaving traces. Okay, let's move now from the rules for individuals and the discussion which we had about ownership to rules for companies. And I just want to give you three rules which came out of the discussion I had at Amazon. Rule number one, start with a question, not with the data. Many companies come to me and say, oh, we have all this data. Can you help me unleash the value in this data? And then I tell them about what's the value of data. And so actually, first thing I do is I start with what decision do you need to make? And it's very interesting to see how on the surface, very similar companies might have a very, very different DNA. In December last year, I worked with two CEOs of companies which look very similar. H&M in Stockholm and Fast Retailing, which is Uniqlo and others, in Tokyo. And it was amazing to me how H&M absolutely got anything and everything data. So it was just a pleasure. For instance, we talked about the website and how very different it is in the physical world compared to the digital world. Because in e-commerce, let's say an item isn't selling. So the question is, what of the many actions we could take, should we take? Maybe the price is too high compared to comparison to others. So we lower the price. Maybe the color is wrong. So we change the inventory. Maybe the sort order is wrong. Maybe that item just doesn't get shown. If I look for white shirts, it just doesn't show up in the product list. In that case, we should change the search results. And these are very, very different actions which belong to very different pricing, people buy, people do the website, very different parts of the company. They totally got it. They're using a company called Dynamic Action, which actually does a super job. They also power all of Victoria's Secret, in case you want to know a secret, to actually do all the stuff for them now. In contrast with Yanai-san, it's a company which does not have a data DNA. And the people he trusts tend to be people who have been with Uniqlo for 30 years. They were the store manager in that store. And I don't think it's just the problem that I don't speak Japanese and it has to go through translation. I think it had zero effect on how they think. They said they want science. They want a scientist. But, you know, none of that data stuff. Experiments? Oh, no, none of the experiment stuff, no. We know what's best for the customer. So these are two very different companies. By the way, I love Uniqlo, just to be clear. You know, half of my clothes are from Uniqlo. But I was very surprised to see that difference in the mindset of two, to the consumer, relatively similar looking companies in one and the same months. So starting with the question, not with the data. Sometimes I say here, you know, it is really to celebrate curiosity, that questions are more important than answers. And particularly in this world where you can get answers to anything just with a couple of keystrokes on your mobile phone. Whether they are correct or not is a different question. Starting with the questions is the important part. So we talked about one specific example, which was the example of finance, whether to give somebody a loan. I, starting with the question or with the problem, want to give you another specific example, namely what recommendations to make to somebody. And I want to talk about, as I did with the loan, about the couple of examples I gave, data sources you might not have heard about. I want to give you some examples of what data sources we looked at Amazon to base recommendations on. And given that this class has sort of this privacy angle to it, I want you to think about each of them, whether there is actually some privacy risk or whether you can use the data source without ever knowing who that person really was. All right? So I want to go historically. At the beginning, Amazon had no data. So Amazon hired experts who figured out, just like in a bookstore, well, people like that kind of book. They always, sometimes at least, they might be interested into that kind of book. So we used experts to seed the start because there was no data. Then soon, machine learning techniques came and natural language processing and said, we want to help the experts. We want to help them maybe with a bag of words model of the description of this book to see what other books might be coming up that use similar words in the summary of the book. So computers helping people. But that was a problem that we only had still a few dozen people. Now came the radical shift where we said, we have these millions of customers who all produce data. Can't we use the data they produce? And the answer, of course, was yes. Otherwise, I wouldn't be standing here. So the first data source people have is that they search. And they change their searches, called query refinement, how you change your searches. And that meant that we learn. People start with a search like this later on, and Google does this very transparently by doing the completion where you start a search and then you see what autocompletes as, by helping people, you know, get up with ideas, come up with ideas just based on the searches. Then there are clicks. So here's a search and you see 10 items. So which of these 10 items do people click at? Then we have purchases. So it's people click at X, also click at Y, shows you substitutes, things you might buy instead of something else. People buy this, also buy that, shows you complements, shows you things that go with it. If you buy a camera, it might show you an SD card. So none of these are from experts. All of those come from the behavior people can't avoid leaving on the site. And from the privacy angle, none of those have anything to do with the individual. So nowhere does it say people like you also like those things. But it's just based on the clicks within a session, irrespective of who the person is. So there's really no privacy issue at all. Then we look at context. There's a context which is already made implicit by the query you do. Namely, if you say digital camera, then you're probably earlier in the funnel than if you say Canon and then the specific model type, Mark IV. Then you know, oh, that person really knows what he wants and probably is now comparison shopping for price. That is the context you are in the shopping. With Amazon's acquisition of Whole Foods in May last year, and also with a patent Amazon got granted in May last year, which allows them to rewrite content as you're using the free Wi-Fi in a store. So let's say you're doing a Google query, and Google typically there would be an ad for Best Buy coming up, but not if you're at Whole Foods. Amazon has the patent that they can rewrite what's showing up while you're using the free Wi-Fi on your phone. Of course, only to sue other companies who might be doing that. So you have access to the information which you as a customer, of course, deserve to have. So the context you're in, which aisle are you standing at? I'm on the board of a company called Percolata. Greg Tanaka is the CEO. It's Palo Alto based. And they do in-store analytics. The camera sitting in store, doing AI, trying to figure out what you want, whether you're happy, whether you're not happy. And John Taysom, formerly from Reuters Capital, told me that there's a company in London which doesn't only do face recognition, but also ankle recognition. So they have cameras in the store, just where you walk, which tries to figure out by the socks you wear what kind of person you are. It recognizes your ankles. I'm not kidding. There's also another company which does ankle recognition when you're not wearing socks. And from that, they do all kinds of inference about your health, how healthy you are and stuff. So if you're sleeping, don't let your foot, you know, hang under the blanket out there. So lots of data sources to measure the context of the person. And the last one is, of course, the social context. At Amazon, we tried a feature called Share the Love. Here's how it worked. As you had just bought an item, we asked you as a customer whether you know anybody who might be interested in that item. It was framed that the person got an email saying, your pal Andreas just bought, blah, and thought you might be interested in it. And it had amazing conversion rates because it was a clear personalized message. It was true they didn't make it up that I just bought the item. I really bought that item. And as a result for that, the other person said, wow, you know, maybe if Andreas made that decision, I should buy it too. So what is the context, not of me buying the item, but of me talking about recommendations? Let's summarize what we've done so far. Rules that customers should have were, one, the rule to see your data, two, the right to blur your data, and three, the right to port your data. Corresponding rules that companies should follow, and both of them came from my time at Amazon, was one, the right or the rule to start with the data. True. You know how it goes. 1 hour into a lecture, 50% of the students have fallen asleep. The other half is having sexual fantasies. So let's try this again. I haven't woken up. First, the question is, what rights should consumers have towards the data? The first right is to see your data, transparency. Second right is that you should be able to do something with your data, to blur your data, to determine the resolution of your data. And the third right is that you should be able to take your data wherever you want to take them, the right to port your data. Three rules for companies are, one, to start with a problem, not with the data. Because in this day and age of exponentially growing data, if you start with the data, you'll never get started. Two, embrace transparency. Now that means both internally to be transparent within the organization. For instance, Whole Foods, everybody in a shop can see how much anybody else gets paid, but also externally, helping customers make better decisions, for instance, by putting reviews up on the website. And third, to respect and to empower the consumer. That means to help people make better decisions. The unifying framework around all these rights for consumers and rules for companies is what I call the fitness function, where we have hundreds of terms, each of them describing interaction between the individual and the company with a weight that we believe should be given to that term. A weight that is positive for interactions which we think are good for the customer and negative for interactions which we think are not good for the customer. Another way of saying this is to make the implicit explicit. Another way of saying that is to make the implicit explicit. So the feeling that people have, we should do it this way, make it explicit. Put a number in front of it. Is this twice as good? Is it five times as good? So these are very quickly some rules of what I thought we should have. We also talked about the value of data, that the value of data is the decisions this data impacts. Time to take a break. Nobody can sit through 2 hours. Let's take a 5 minutes break. And then what I want to do in the last part is I want to look at a few specific examples And I want you to get to think about dating sites, because that clearly is an interesting data source which we have now. So 5 minute break, we'll be back according to that clock at 3:26.
Don't forget to do the long short on privacy question. I think
good.
That's a great one.
Yes, that's good. So let's, you know, my class always is 3 hours, so I'm so used to a 3 hour cycle that I was not realizing there's only a 2 hour class, yeah. So long short.
The other thing I would ask you if I had.
Yes, two.
If I was going to ask you a question.
Yeah.
So I know you're not a law policy guy, but in the law, you know, you have mandatory rules and default rules. And a default rule is just a starting point from which people negotiate. And so if we were to think about something like, you own your data, so therefore a company has to ask you permission to use it to generate recommendations for others. Mm-hmm. I think most people would not even hesitate to say, okay, in exchange for,
yeah,
you know, the only way I can benefit from other people's data is if I give you access to my data. I don't think anybody would say no. And yep. So the default rules almost don't matter, because you'd always wind up in the same exact spot.
Yep. Yep.
So that would be...
So I asked the long short. Yeah, let me think how I organize. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, but that's yeah. That might be too real.
Yeah. I'm so used to 3 hours that, you know,
time flies.
It's just realized, you know, we only have like 30 minutes left.
Yeah.
Oh, and I was not concentrated at the end. I mean, you saw, you know, it's just hard to concentrate sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, yeah.
And so you said you have office hours after this, right?
Yeah, I have an hour afterwards, and then 5 to 6 is office hours.
Okay.
And so we have time to talk about other stuff,
okay.
But 5 to 6 for the students, and then it's again downtime at 7 o'clock is dinner.
Okay.
And I should push that to Greg to organize.
To tell. To join for dinner,
absolutely, whoever wants to come.
Okay.
Yeah, great. If you have time, awesome.
Yeah.
That would be sweet, yeah.
So directly after this, did you want to film other things? Or?
We should do a couple of shots. I don't know whether this room is free, but... I know you have to leave for the airport. What time do you have to leave?
Well, it's fine. I mean, you have to be somewhere at 5 or something, right?
Yeah, we have office hour. I have office hour at 5. So I think I would do 2. It's surprising how... Actually, it's difficult to concentrate in a new group of people. And the other guy said, you know, I have to talk about this and this and this. You should do this. He should do it. Okay.
Yeah.
So yeah, we'll find the spot afterwards. So I left the timing relatively spacious.
Mm-hmm.
So break down here, leave with mics on, do maybe 2 or 3 short segments. Yeah, so when I was preparing for this, absolutely impossible. Even at the end when I tried the summary, I mean, I was just not concentrated enough to pull it off. You saw there was one sentence which I just repeated the sentence because I just misspoke. You know where it was. I just...
I have to go.
Yeah,
it
was just like 5 minutes. And when I attempted the summary, I just said the wrong thing and I just said exactly the same sentence again. If you can cut it, it's... It's just pretty much towards the end, 5 minutes before the end. So when I tried to do that summary, if not...
5 minutes before this break?
Yeah.
I'll write down.
I looked at you. I looked right in your eyes at that moment.
Okay.
I want to do the thing on projecting the questions people have. So for that, we need to have one of Nick's camera on the screen. Let me see whether I can pull this off. How many of you have like laptops? If we do Google Doc where people can write their questions, do you think that works, or do you think that's too tedious for people? Yeah. Can I then ask, maybe since you have a laptop here, just to quickly make a Google Doc and give it a short URL, and then I will write on the board. So make it. No, no, just through a Google Doc. Google Doc, make it word read, right?
Okay.
You know what I'm talking about, right? Google Doc.
So I can just share it with
And I would just write on the board. If you give, write on a piece of paper the URL, the short URL. Right. So Google Doc, call it whatever, data, whatever you want. And then share, make it word read, right? So we don't have to deal with permissions. Go to advanced. And advanced. What's the permission here? Edit. Do you have everybody edit?
I was just wondering whether you
and no, make it worldwide.
Make it
worldwide. Like anybody.
Oh,
worldwide.
Okay. Yeah.
So anyone.
Anyone, yeah. Okay.
Very top. On, okay. Great. Can edit. Save. And now make a short link, and I write that link on a piece of paper. Nick, what will happen now is I want one camera on the screen, because we'll do what we missed before. And that I'll ask them to write questions on the board, on a Google Doc which was made, and I want one camera just really on the screen.
Okay.
And then you'll see how on the screen zoomed in.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sounds great.
So this one?
Whichever one, just one, just simply having the screen. So after the fact.
Okay. Sounds good.
Good. Thank you. Okay. Yes.
So
can you write this
sure.
here and write it right on the board?
Okay.
Right on the board. Greg, can we please project the screen?
Yeah.
Because we want to do the exercise now. And there's a pin. This screen is good. One screen is, as we did before, one screen is good enough. Okay.
So, and you want something
on? Yes, this tiny URL, the one he just wrote down.
Why is it not?
I turned this one off. Yep. Is this an L or an E?
It's an E.
E, okay.
Okay.
Make it an E.
Yeah.
Little E is a little E, right?
It's not so tiny.
Okay.
No, this
that's also an E?
Yeah.
Okay.
YBX.
Yeah.
YBX.
No, no dot. No dot. No dot. No dot.
No dot.
No, YBX. Ego. Okay, great. No, not yet. No dot. Sorry. Okay, so let me. Great. What is it? Tiny URL. Just put it in here. Tiny. Just if you just put the.
Okay.
Great.
Questions.
Great, URL, perfect. No, don't write the text. The tiny URL.
Oh,
we want
okay.
to have the URL in there,
okay.
so people can
okay.
see it.
Sure.
Exactly.
Yes.
Okay. Okay, perfect, great.
Okay.
Okay. And then... All right, this is a large class. So rather than asking individually what you found interesting and what questions you might have. We have here a Google Doc where I ask you to just think for a moment and then write on the top things that you actually thought were interesting, and at the bottom of the Doc, wherever we are, things you're curious about. And then
no device policy is waived.
The no device policy is waived. That's, I hope, yeah, that's clear. So I want people to take out their laptops. And I always believe that if we can't compete with the devices, there's something wrong with our lecture as opposed to with the students. Good. And please put on top things that you thought were interesting, things you enjoyed learning that you didn't know 1.5 hours ago. And the bottom, put down questions. And then I use the last half hour to go and pick those which are interesting. Ready? Let's see what's showing up here. Great. So I love what's coming out here. Now, let's quickly look at the questions and let people see what they feel is really interesting. I already know the topic which I want to move to is right there. So I'm actually happy that something which is close to my heart is reflecting what you had. Do you need more time, or let's say 2 more minutes? Let me read from the top, and then when I'm at the bottom, I'll answer. All right, I think this is more than enough for me to work with you. Let me start here with 22. And I want to quote Marshall McLuhan. As information itself becomes the largest business in the world, data banks know more about individual people than the people do themselves. And then he goes on and says, the more the data bank records about each of us, the less we exist. I think the opposite is true. The more data that is being created about us, the more we exist. So we are the decisions we make. And as we leave traces, I think the more traces we leave, the more we actually exist. So that's one point here. Question number 8. How do I think about the right to port with the collecting? It is no longer about collecting data. It's about connecting data. So if I think about the history of the last 50 years, in the 70s, we learned to build computers. The 80s, we learned to connect computers. The 90s, we learned to connect pages. Google, of course, PageRank being one of the examples. In the 2000s, we learned to connect people. Facebook, WeChat. I think in this decade, it is about connecting data where the value lies. Yes. So, looping back to the question of Cambridge Analytica at the beginning of class today, and this is not the first time. A few years ago, Rapleaf was busted by the Wall Street Journal of basically having illegally gotten the Facebook data and built all the profiles they had based on Facebook data. And so there always are attempts for companies sucking the data out and then monetizing them, as in this case of Rapleaf was the case, and the company went under basically after they were no longer allowed to access Facebook data. So in the past, companies used to make money by building barriers to data. I think now company makes money by reducing barriers to data. Think about Google. What Google does, it reduces barriers to information. And of course, it shows you ads on the way. In some way, people have to make money. And I don't have a problem with that. But there are some things which are like sign flips, where the notion of trying to build a wall, which worked well in the old world, back to Kim.com here, might not work as well anymore. Or in other words, other ways of monetizing, of connecting data, might be more lucrative than the past monetizing, collecting data. I want to give you another few examples of sign flips, because as a physicist, I'm always interested, not if something is a percent different, but if something actually changes the sign. In the 90s, caller ID was invented. And there was a very strong movement of saying, I am not using that. I mean, it's none of the business of the people who I'm calling to know that it's me who is calling. I am pushing that *67 or whatever it was to not have my number transmitted. See how that sign flipped? Now, if a call comes in as unknown, I'm not answering. So it's beautiful, I think, to see how sometimes a society as a whole changes its behavior, changes its attitude towards data. When I was an undergraduate, it was illegal to unplug the phone. The purpose of the government was to protect the network from its users. Now, if you think about net neutrality, the purpose of the government is to protect the users from the network. Again, very interesting how our attitude to data has changed. I already mentioned earlier that Amazon, revolutionary, encouraged people to write on the website. Rather than carefully protecting, you know, the brand, they said, please be my guest, here, write a review, and we'll publish it. Airlines, for a long time, tried to fool customers. Then, for example, for seats, Seat Guru came along. And you know exactly what to get or what not to get in a seat like United with the Polaris. You know, what a joke. It is still the same seats they had, years ago. It's now just called, United Polaris as opposed to business class. Here's another interesting example. My friend Justin Abachi, who used to be the chief data guy at Starlines, now runs for Los Angeles the innovation for the airports. It used to be that the airport had to pay for Wi-Fi. Now the airport gets paid by installing Wi-Fi. And about $1 million a year, LAX. Why? Because companies which make decisions on where to put which retail store at the airport, they want to know where do which customers go. That's a sign flip, where as opposed to you paying for something good, you get paid. When I parked my car this morning, I was reminded of the company which also has parking spots here at Berkeley, where initially, in the olden days, you had to pay to leave your car at the airport. When you go for a trip, you leave your car and you pay quite a bit. And they said, flip that bit. We pay you if you leave your car here, provided, of course, you let us use the car and rent it out. And so that's another information play here. Walmart. I gave a talk at Walmart at their Big Data Day. And traditionally, they used to really try to be as non-sharing of data with the suppliers as possible. Then they tried something called Retail Link, which gave the supplier visibility onto the shelf. And it turned out that that was better for the entire ecosystem. So rather than just putting the screws really tight on the supplier, look, if you want to adjust your processes, given what you see in our shops, please. But there was one caveat. Walmart being who they are, they said, of course, if we share our data with you, you also have to share what you sell at our competitors with us. So that means not only did the suppliers get visibility onto Walmart shelves, but Walmart got visibility on its competitor shelves. Interesting, actually, 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago, as you might have seen, Walmart dipped, I think, about 10% the stock. And that was due to a predictive analytics problem last year, that they simply had bad model to know what should have been on the shelves in December. And when those earnings announcement came out and it was clear how inferior their data mining was compared to that of Amazon, the stock market did react quite strongly. So there are many more examples, and what I wanted just to get across here is that notion of a sign flip. And that is an example of what I call data literacy. Because at the end of the day, when we think, what can we do? I think it is that we should think about how can we become more data literate. So if we step back for a moment in time, literacy, some people put it at the technology that was invented in Germany. Gutenberg, who invented the printing press, gave rise to the Reformation, to the revolution in the church, if you will. And literacy rate is not as high as you might think in the world. I just look up the numbers, and in my lifetime, literacy rates increased from 50%. When I was born, only half of the people in the world could read and write, to about 85% now, which is still not that much. Afghanistan, for instance, has only 38% literacy rate. India, only 72%. So that means 28% in India cannot read or write. So we are easily fooling ourselves and thinking that literacy is, you know, in the 90s or something like that. I experienced every year for the last 17 years what it means to be functionally illiterate for a couple of months every year. I bought a house in Shanghai after that meeting with Jack Ma, I showed the picture of before, and I cannot read Chinese, cannot write Chinese, cannot speak Chinese. I know it's pathetic, but you know, it's just, you know, the way it is. The pressure was never strong enough. They always had good enough translators with me that I never really learned to read or write Chinese. So it's getting worse every time I'm there, because so much now runs on apps that, you know, my Chinese is good enough to tell the taxi driver to take me home. But, you know, a screen of Chinese characters, I know what it is. I know what it feels like to be functionally illiterate. And it really sucks, where even you can't read the sign for the bathroom. I mean, come on, how ridiculous is this? But that's what, you know, 20% of the world is still about. So, however, I am illiterate in Chinese. I am not data illiterate. So what we should think about here is, what does it mean to be data literate? The example I gave you is to look for sign flips, for things that only change by a bit, but that actually change the sign. One of my pet peeves is many newspapers having big numbers, 73%. And then in really small font, you know what it means. That's exactly the wrong way. I don't understand, how can a journalist think that way? Because in most cases, it doesn't matter whether it's 73 or 70 or 80. What matters is, what question are they answering? But you all have seen those stupid graphics where, you know, big number and you don't know what the number means. I fail to understand how data literate people can do that. So one thing about data literacy is, you have to know that everything has an error associated with that. Nothing really is exact. That every data you get, you need to interpret to come to the meaning. And physicists are particularly good at understanding how errors propagate. Physicists are also very good at understanding what the dimensions of the space are. So data literacy means that you know what the units are. It means that you know what to focus on. So for example, when we write down that equation of business, the question is, from which perspective? What is the unit of analysis? Is it the item, the SKU? Is it the store? Traditionally, it was a store as unit of analysis. Is it maybe the cashier, the woman who sits there or the man who sits there and rings you up? Or maybe is it you, the customer, just as a suggestion? Or maybe is it your credit card, which they know as you check out? Or maybe is it your household? So those are all good questions to ask. And data literacy means that, you know, those are relevant questions. What are the axes of the space? What is the unit of analysis? So, yeah, data literacy, importance of literacy. A few questions here were about privacy versus security in this list. The way I view this is think about it like a distribution. And the CFO of Deutsche Telekom, the T-Mobile parent company in Germany, visited me a year and a half ago. So what I should say, I live in San Francisco and I have a house where we don't wear shoes. So I mean, just, you know, take your shoes off when you get in. And so he came to my house. He thought it would be an office, but it was just my home with two people. And as I asked him, you know, do you mind taking your shoes off? I might as well have asked him, do you mind taking your pants off? So asking somebody to take his shoes off, which I routinely do, was just not a question he probably had ever been asked before. But so he complied eventually, kept his pants on, took his shoes off. And then after we warmed up, he said something very interesting. He said, Andreas, it is actually quite hard to cross the Atlantic. And I thought, I'm sure his flying Lufthansa first class is not that bad. But that's not what it was. What it was is he said, in Europe, people focus on the downside. I, as CFO, constantly have to answer questions about data, like, what is the worst case that can happen? If you have a security breach at Telekom, at T-Mobile, what is the worst case? And then I land San Francisco. Nobody asked me that. They asked me, what's the best case that can happen? And that really beautifully actually exemplifies and illustrates the two minds, the two kinds of thinking about data that I've, you know, experienced having two passports here, and that I do experience every time I go back. That here the focus is, you know, what can we build? What's possible? In Germany it is, what's permissible? And that goes back, you know, I wanted to end the talk on the post-privacy economy. So I think we have established by now that we have no privacy and that all the data about us is knowable. But this is the business school. So what is the post-privacy economy? How do we now price our privacy? And the thought I want to end on was, when I landed here in 86, that's 32 years ago, it's a long time ago, when I landed and I decided between Stanford and Berkeley for grad school, and you know which one I picked, I did my thesis actually on neural networks, which was pretty avant-garde at the time. I did the first thesis on neural networks for prediction. And my first week, I show up at Slack, where I did, you know, internship, the Stanford Linux Service, and my advisor, Jonathan Dorfman, gives me a terminal and a modem. And says, you know, take this to you. I lived in a trailer, just to set scale. I know you all live in fancy dorms here. I lived in a trailer with two other people in the first 2 years. Take this to your dorm, meaning trailer, and turn it on in the morning, and when you go to bed, just turn it off. I thought that was crazy. In Germany, the rates were metered, and my dad, who was a high school teacher, his salary would have been not sufficient to pay for all these connection costs, which here in the US, the default, the economics of communication just was a different one because local calls were free. So I think it is amazing how the economics of communication, how the economics of data I think has huge effects in how societies develop. And ultimately, I think it's our task as educated people here at a pretty good school to think about what we can do towards data literacy, what we can do not to increase the gap between the data literate and the data illiterate, but to try to bridge it, to help people understand the data, just as we learn to interpret marks on paper and to make meaning out of characters, or not, as is my case in Chinese, to help people make meaning out of numbers. So that's something which, you know, is what drove me to write that book. I wanted, you know, the world to be a better place in people understanding the data that we create and share, whether we want it or not, data of the people and by the people. That I want that to be data for the people, not against the people. And every aspect of society is affected by that. We have right now going on here the conference of the future of work. Should we be instrumented? Should our browsers know when we are slacking off at work? Should we wear a Fitbit and when we come into work in the morning, the boss say, I see you didn't sleep well last night. Maybe you just go back to bed. And, you know, this is an important meeting. We need people who are really in good shape this morning. So I think we don't need you today. Or is this our own private thing, how much we sleep, how well we sleep? Health, for sure, is an amazing company in South Africa called Discovery Health. And I did a workshop with them in Chicago here in the United States. And they truly address the problem of insurance, of not having it as a zero-sum game, what insurance traditionally is, but trying to turn it into a win-win game, which means that if you have a happy and a healthy consumer, insured person, then actually it's good for every person, for everybody, for every party in that equation, including the insurance company and, of course, the person, because they'll have less claims if they know what to eat, if they know, you know, how to exercise, if they do it actually. Work, live, and the last topic, of course, is the future of love. But that I have a whole chapter on in my book, where I talk about dating sites. I did work for Match.com, for Gay.com. I was in the board, as I said, of Scout and another few dating sites in Europe and in Asia. So I have a bunch of examples. And my favorite one is of a dating site where you actually can see who the other person really is engaging with. So they might say they are interested, you know, irrespective of age, but everybody they click on is below 20. So, you know, if you are above 20, then, you know, it might not be worth your time, really, to try to hit them up, because you're probably it's not going very far, that conversation. So things that used to be very private, like what you say or what you click on a dating site, now gets used to actually, you know, I would say better data, better matches. So that was a very quick run around a few verticals: work, health, love, many more. But we have reached the end of the class. I thank you for your attention. And that's it.
Thank you. Thank you.